Today is April 21st, 2003. This is Christine Navarro interviewing Dr. Richard H. Hancock in El Paso, Texas. Good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Well, I'm fine.
Can you tell me a little bit about when and where you were born?
Well, I was born in Alpine, Texas in 1926, January 19th, 1926.
Okay. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Corona, New Mexico.
And when did you start working for the Donna Anna Farm Bureau?
I started, I think, in probably May of 1951.
Okay. Did you have any training, or what brought you to this?
Well, I had some training in an informal sense. I graduated from New Mexico State University in 1950, and I went to work with the Foot and Mouth Commission in Mexico, and worked in Jalisco. And I grew up speaking Spanish, but a year in Mexico helped my Spanish a great deal and my cultural sensitivity. And my father, who was a rancher in Corona, New Mexico, while I was in the Foot and Mouth, he sold his ranch in Corona. He was getting old by then. And he bought a farm near Mesilla, New Mexico. And so I decided, rather than stay on with the Foot and Mouth, that I would come home and help him farm. And I had been home, just barely been home, and I went to a Farm Bureau local that my parents belonged to, and we met the executive secretary there, and he, you know, I told him what I'd been doing, and he says, well, how would you like a job? And he says, we've got these braceros coming in, and we need a labor director who can speak Spanish and English. And I said, well, sure, why not? So I worked there until spring of 1955, and went to Stanford University and completed my doctoral program there in 1959. And at that time, I learned that the executive secretary's position was open at Donna Anna County, so I took that. And I worked at that 1959 through a large part of 61. So basically I had about 5, 7, or 8 years in the Bracero program.
What made you decide to leave the program and go to Stanford and earn your...
Well, I got interested in Spanish, and I think I was kind of burnt out on the job. I found myself more interested in the braceros and talking to them than I was in doing my job. So I decided I'd go off. And during that, the time that I worked at New Mexico State or Donna Anna County, I got a master's degree at New Mexico State in Spanish. So I finished my degree there, and I kind of liked studying, so I decided I'd go off to Stanford. And I did. Met my wife there, so that was not bad.
And your dissertation topic, can you tell me the title of your...
Well, you know, I hope I can remember it. It was the Bracero program in the culture and the economic and cultural dynamics of Mexico, the case of Chihuahua. I hope I have that right, but really was a case study of Chihuahua, and also the history of where they went, what they did, the type of work they did, and what impact this had on different communities. In other words, I chose four different communities in Chihuahua, municipios, to study. One was down in the irrigated district, on the Conchos River. Another was in a desert area, which near Chihuahua City, Aldama. Another was in the mountain area, Guerrero. And another was Janos, Chihuahua, where they didn't provide any braceros. So I used that as kind of a check on the rest of them. And these other three were heavy providers of braceros. And I went down there and talked to the presidentes and the priests and the businessmen and returned braceros and got their ideas of what was good, what was the impact of the bracero program. And I concluded that it was a valuable impact.
Tell me why.
Well, one thing, I'm talking about for our nation, I was talking to a man, I can't remember where, and told him that I was doing a study on the bracero program, and he said to me, my uncle runs the post office in Gomez Farias, Chihuahua. In that time, Chihuahua was not well communicated. There was probably a lot of, you could go down the Pan American Highway and there was one or two fairly decent roads going off laterally, and the rest of it was just terrible. We had a 1956 Chevrolet, and we would do things like drive to a place 90 miles away and it'd take us 8 hours to get there, just a battle. And we tried to get into the mountains, the Sierra Madre, and we never could because there were no roads. We were going to ride the train one day, and we drove up. That train was a real Toonerville trolley in those days, and we drove up as far as we could go in our car, and the train was in the station, and so we got on, bought a ticket, and it stood in the station for 4 hours, and they finally said the train is broken down, and we've sent for another one. It'll be here tomorrow. So we went on back to Chihuahua City, and when we finally finished, we rented an airplane to fly out over the mountains just so we could see it. And the mountain areas of Chihuahua and just many other areas were totally inaccessible. I mean, Janos was one of those places. And we went to Janos, it was just totally inaccessible. But to get to your question about why I had this man, Gomez Farias, this is in the mountain area, and Gomez Farias has a road through it now, not too inaccessible, but was then very inaccessible. And he says, my uncle tells me that there's a lot of communist propaganda coming through his post office in Gomez Farias. He says, the Russians are sending their magazine, America, and it's a beautiful magazine. And he says, people come in, they haven't got anything to do, and want to know where their copy of America is, the Russian magazine. And he said, it would have a tremendous effect, a propaganda effect on our town, except that nearly everybody's been to the United States. He says, they just read it because it's a nice, pretty, colorful magazine, but said they've all been to the United States and they've seen it. And so they know pretty much where it is. But these people, they made some money. And really, it goes for the wetback system too. It's a big safety valve for Mexico. It was then, and it is now. And people, if we you know, some people want to keep the Mexican in Mexico. We can't, because we don't want a revolution down there. We don't want unrest. So we should have a legal program to allow Mexicans to work in the United States and have the safeguards of a minimum wage at least, and insurance, and a period of contract guaranteed work. The Becerra program had all those things. And, you know, the wetback program, I just can't, particularly religious people that oppose the Becerra program, I don't see how they feel like that the wetback program is better. It's not a program, it's just a... And so I think it was very necessary to Mexico, because people had a way out. You know, if they got hard up and were broke and hungry, they'd come to the United States and get a fairly decent job and send some money home and keep the country from blowing up, you know. And also they learned new technologies, obviously, you know. Braceros, it was kind of misused, I expect, in a way, and that's one reason they opposed it. The farmer would get a bracero who was reliable, and most of them, in comparison to the local people, were extremely reliable, good workers. And so they're there, you know, they could stay 18 months, but then they get recontracted and stay in another 18 months. And then pretty soon they were driving tractors, you know, driving bulldozers. They were doing very skilled things and probably were being underpaid for that. But to them, it was a good job, you know, and so they didn't complain. So they learned how to farm in a modern high-tech fashion, and they brought some money home, and I just know hundreds of cases when they went home, they would take tools with them and use clothing and all this kind of stuff, and they benefited from it, and they kept returning year after year. And some of them, of course, became legalized. And even though they became legalized, some of them went back even after they became legalized, because they kind of made a way for themselves. You know, they had a little capital and so on. So I think over the years, I don't see anything bad about it. And my father, he ran his farm, and he had a man by the name of Manuel, and I don't remember his last name. I wish I did, but he came in, he'd ran his farm, and I was working for the Farm Bureau, and he says, "I want to legalize Manuel." And I says, "Dad, why are you doing this? You don't need any workers. You're renting your farm." "No," he says, "Manuel wants me to legalize him, so I'm going to do it." I said, "Well, okay." So we got him legalized. And my father died. And Manuel and his family were very good to my mother. See, we were working all over the United States. We came there during my father's illness. But, you know, I was working in Oklahoma, and one brother's working in California, one brother in New York. And Manuel filled Central Land Force. They had come by and mow my mother's yard every week. And they would invite her out to go to some gathering in Juarez. And they were a great help to her. And I figure that's, you know, you cast bread upon the water, you know. And those were awfully good people. Those Mexicans, I remember we had a big farmer there, you know, Stallman Farms, no doubt. Well, I used to go with him to give programs to Farm Bureau locals. And he had braceros, and he legalized them all. And he had 150. And he told me, he said, "I don't understand it." He says, the parents, those people, women and men, were the best people in the world when I legalized them. And he says, their children are not worth a damn. And he says, why is that? He says, I blame the schools. And I think it's this. I think that you came into a different world. And the kids went to school and they came home and said, Dad, you know, this and that happened. And the dad gave them answers like, you know, pray to the Blessed Virgin or something, particularly the mothers. And this just wasn't relevant to them. And so they took their advice from their peers, and that's the worst advice they could get.
That's true. For the record, could I ask you your parents' full names, please? Your father's full name and your parents.
My father was Henry Lee Hancock. My mother was Mary Gillette Hancock, and she was born in Marfa, Texas, and he was born in Alpine, Texas. And they, you know, they spoke Spanish being down there on the border, and in New Mexico and in Corona, most of our workers were Mexicans, and we had a family, a man and wife, and the wife worked in the house, and the man on the farm, or on the ranch. And so our language, both out on the job and in the house, was pretty much Spanish. And that's where I got my Spanish. It's been a real blessing to me. And it wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been by an accident of birth, you know. See, I wouldn't be in Chihuahua doing these things for the governor if I couldn't speak Spanish.
Definitely. Can you describe your role as the labor director and as also the executive secretary for the...
Well, as the labor director, I was the, I would communicate with the farmers how many workers you wanted to get, and then I would schedule with Rio Vista the appropriate numbers that we would want to get. And then we would bring them in. We had a kind of a bullpen there at the Don Yana County Farm Bureau. And
where was that located?
That was located on the railroad there. And I can't remember the...
That's okay.
The address, but it was located in a commercial area of Las Cruces, and located, you know, in the kind of the warehouse area along the Farm Bureau. Now, you know, you all interviewed Bobby Jack Porter, and he could tell you exactly where that is. Okay. I don't know whether it's there anymore or not.
And as executive secretary, labor director.
I would take the orders from the farmers and dish out the workers to the braceros to the farmers. And we were not a big farm operation. We had, I suppose, you know, the average farmer in the Doña Ana County then probably didn't have over 2 workers during the year, and maybe have 10 or 12 at the end of the, you know, in the harvest time. And there was a quite a personal relationship with the workers, because they weren't big farmers, you know, and of course irritated me that the anti-bracero people said that this program was to help corporate farmers, and we didn't have any corporate farmers, you know. And I suspect that there were not a lot anywhere in the United States. I still don't think there are a lot, you know, because they're big family farms, you know. And so then we'd get them, dish them out to the farmers, and for the most part, didn't have a lot of trouble. But amongst, say, 600 farmers and 10,000 workers, I and another fellow worked this job. His name was Epifanio Apodaca, and he's dead now. But he would go out north, and I would go out south, vice versa, and we'd settle strikes. And he would, and then when we settled one, we'd call into the office, and they'd say, "Well, go down to Chamberino, they got another one there." I'd go down there and talk and find out what the problem was. And
what was the main problem for the cause of the strikes?
Disagreement of mostly picking, you know, during the picking season. And the farmer, you know, you pick the first picking, you pay, I think our wage was $2.05 a hundred. And the first picking, then the second picking, the picking's usually poor, so you pay them less, or you pay them more. And usually, you know, the bracero would say, "Well, this picking's gotten bad," and the farmer would say, "Well, that's good cotton," you know. And then you'd come to an agreement. You know, the farmer didn't want to lose his man, and the bracero didn't want to lose their job. And then when they would, you know, we had a guarantee that you had to give, I'm not sure how many hours, but you had to give like, you know, every 2 weeks, which is normal work week, would be 80 hours. Seemed to me like you had to guarantee 60 hours in 2 week period, and if you fell below that, you had to pay the Mexicans a dollar and a half a day, what they call subsistence. And that was a major complaint. You know, the farmer, see, they would never bring these complaints until they brought them in the end of the year. And they would then say that, well, and you know, you always ask them, "You have any complaints?" We were required to do that. And ask every man, "If you have any complaints, we want to hear it." And they'd say, "Well, yo tuve muchos días de okis. Didn't have any work." See, oki means ocio, but they say okis. And some people say that came from Oklahoma, but I don't think so. And so you'd say, "Well, how many?" 20. Well, that'd mean the farmer would have to pay him $30, you see. And we're talking about, you know, we're not talking $30 was more then than it is now. And so the farmer, that was kind of unpleasant to him. But, you know, we did that kind of thing. And then, all kinds of things. We had a farmer, and I won't mention his name, but his foreman struck a worker, you know, and so we went out there to see what that problem was, and the labor department came down, the guys from Denver, and they had a pretty good session with the farmer, and they were all kind of love and kisses, you know, and the local labor department man kept whispering to me, get them to settle. And I, you know, they just seemed so much in accord. I thought, well, you know, but he kept saying to me, get them to settle, get them to settle. Well, I didn't, and I learned a lesson there, because the farmer left, and the labor department man says, well, Mr. So-and-so seemed like a nice fellow. If he'll just pay this bracero $100, well, we'll just call it even. And I thought, well, yes, right, you know, what's wrong with that? This man's wealthy. What's $100 to him? So I says, okay. And so we paid. The guy was going home, and the Farm Bureau paid him $100. And then we billed the farmer, and he just raised holy hell. He just left us, you know, and went to the he happened to be on the border there, left us and went to the Texas cotton growers, Southwest cotton growers, and just told everybody, just like hiring a loudspeaker to go around town and tell everybody what a bunch of bastards we were, you know. And I haven't forgiven him yet, you know, because we thought we were working in his best interest, and he just told, you know, the farmers have these coffee meetings, and he just told them, you know, Farm Bureau will sell you out at the first chance, you know, you can't, they're not supporting the farmers, they're in league with these government bureaucrats, and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, that's just one of the irritating things that happened. And I, you know, you go out there and you try to find out what's happening. The farmer called me, and he's a nice fellow. And he says, my workers want to go home, and I don't know why. He says, I can't believe they want to go home. So I went out there, and I said, well, what's this? You fellows want to go home. They said, well, we've got to get our corn in. And I says, look, I think they were from Durango. And, you know, maybe from the Laguna down there. Those were the big, good cotton pickers. And they said, well, no, we got to go home. And I smoked a cigar in those days. And I pulled out my cigar, put it in my mouth, and I began to feel for matches. And there was a hard-looking old boy, said, light the senor, like that, you know, sharp command. And I told the farmer, I said, I think I figured out your problem. I said, send that guy off to do something. And he sent him off on the other side of the field to get a tractor or something. And I said, boys, that man is your problem, isn't he? And they said, oh, yes. And, he comes in drunk at 2 o'clock in the morning, makes us get up and cook eggs for him. And he was a real bully. And I mean, the Mexican, in that time, they couldn't move as a group to take care of a guy like that. And the farmer, he says, well, when he comes back, let's just jump him, we'll beat the hell out of him. And the Mexican said, well, that's all right for you, but we live in his town. He's killed 6 men. Says, it's just better for us to go home. And he said, you know, we hate to do it. You've been a good patron, but it's just too risky for us. We just had it. So the guy comes back, and I says, hey, get your stuff. And he says, oh, what's the matter, patron? I said, hell, I won't give you answers. Come with me. I'm changing you. And I put him with one Mexican farmer far north, and they never had either one of them. You know, one farmer, he had the bully there, but he could get along one. And the other guy, his man stayed the whole period and picked his cotton, and everybody went home happy. But they couldn't, there was no way to. Well, you know, he was a killer, and we had some of those guys. And I remember another deal, and I like northern Mexicans because the southern Mexicans were very herd-minded, and it's difficult for them to perform as individuals. Now, anthropologists will say, well, that's what we like about southern Mexicans because they have a community spirit. Well, I'm sure that's true. But you get some of those southern Mexicans, and they would come in a group of, say, 30 or 40, and we didn't get very many of them because we we like to have the Chihuahuans, which are basically quite a lot like Americans. You know, if they go one man to do something, well, they'll do it, and they don't have to have some companions go with them or something. But I've had many of those southern Mexicans. One young radical kind of guy would do all the talking for them. And you'd have guys 50 years old, and you'd ask them, well, what is your complaint? And they say, oh, lo que dice mi compañero. And so you with those guys, you're always dealing with the leader. And with the northern Mexicans, you were dealing with individuals. And now some people will say, well, sure, you like people that don't organize so you can exploit them better. You know, individuals. But I remember one time we went up on a farm way up north, and there was a farmer had two Mexicans up there, and one of them was from the south, and one of them was from Durango or Chihuahua, and we'd had a complaint. This guy came to the office and said, he employed me and he hasn't given me any work. This is the winter time. And these guys, a lot of times, would beg the farmer to renew their contract. And the farmer would say, well, we don't have any work in the winter, but, you know, if you really want to, I guess I can employ you and give you whatever work I can. Well, he had this subsistence payment, and you know, if you had a guy, say you had him for a month or 2 months, or I think in this case 6 months, and he probably hadn't given him 6 weeks of work in that time, and so you had to pay him $1.50 a day for all the days he's short of the guarantee. And so this guy came in and told us about that, and we went up there. Was a Hispanic farmer, and we told him, said, these guys from the south, they could live on about $12 a week, and the northern Mexicans probably 20-25, and so we went up there and told this guy, said, you know, you owe this guy some subsistence. And he said, well, you know, he asked me to contract him, but I guess I'll just have to pay him. And he paid him. And I asked the other bracero, I said, do you have any complaints? He said, no. He says, and if I had any, I wouldn't have to go to your office to settle them.
That's the difference.
And so we went on down. We had this southern boy, Willis, and we said, well, you know, your friend, has he been getting more work than you? And he said, no. And he said, well, he seems to be doing all right. And he says, well, said he's a guy that's killed some people in our country. And he said, the farmer is afraid to mistreat him.
So, that'll do it. Were any of the workers or the farmers afraid to come to you or ask for your assistance?
No, I don't think so, because we were honest about this. Our Farm Bureau board wanted us to abide by the contract. And they would be tougher on violators than we would. You know, we had to work with these people. And if the board were asked to deal with them, they'd just be tough on them, because they basically were obeying the rules, and they thought, well, this guy's not obeying the rules, and act with him, you know. And I had another incident that I got a good deal of satisfaction out of. I had a farmer, and I didn't know anything about his personal business, but he had a Mexican foreman who was an ex-Army sergeant, and he was a real tough guy. He was a tough nut. And if these workers didn't, if they complained anything, he'd invite them to settle it with their fists. And he was tough. He always won. And these people, we'd give this guy, and he had a pretty good bunch of workers, and we would give him workers, and some of them would come in and want to transfer. Well, they were contracted to the Farm Bureau, not to the individual. And we could transfer them, but we didn't, you know, we didn't really want to encourage that very much. And so this guy, his name was Jim, and he always was getting on us, you can't transfer my man, you're just making it easy for these people to give us trouble, and they'll be transferring all over the valley, and you know, you guys have got to stand up for us. And so I went out, got some of his men came in and wanted to transfer, and I went out to Jim's farm, and there he was, and there was an older man with him, had a very southern accent, like a Kentucky colonel. And I said, Jim, we've got the same problem as we've had quite a bit. Their men, some of your men want to transfer. And Jim didn't say anything. And this Kentucky colonel said, why, if these boys don't want to work for us, of course we'll transfer them. And that's the end of the trouble. That man was his financier.
Very good.
and so we never had any more trouble with him. So that was kind of gratifying.
Now, did you handle, just in the Donna Annick area, how many farms would you estimate?
Well, I think we had about 600 farms. And you know, we were very preferred. You know, we'd go to Rio Vista and we'd say we wanted 300 men, and we'd get 1,000 want to go. They much preferred us to going to Texas.
Why?
Well, I hate to say this, but I think Texans were more racist then than you know, New Mexico was half Hispanic. Mm-hmm. And half our farmers were Hispanic. And then also the Texas farms were bigger, and they didn't like to go to big farms. Just, you know, they just had to wait in line to weigh their cotton and wait in line to eat. And you know, there was a lot of noise, and some people were gambling and fighting. And they just preferred to have a smaller. And as I say, our area was an area of small farms.
And how did you determine what, you said 1,000 men would want to go, so how would you tell who would go, how would you decide
well,
who would go, who would not go?
They all had cards from the Farm Bureau, and our farmers would tell us, look out for so-and-so. Then we just kind of, you know, guy shows a card, and he worked last year for Joe Doe in Doniana County, and they, you know, they only gave these cards to those that completed their contract and so on. And so we set a lot of You know, you really didn't interview them much because it was too, but they would approach you and say, I want to go work for Joe Doe there. And you would get them. And even if Joe Doe couldn't take them, you figured they were pretty good workers. And by and large, we didn't have very much trouble. They wanted to work, and the farmers needed the work, and so we got along pretty well, and we even got along pretty well with the Mexican consul. We would occasionally get called on the carpet by the Mexican consul, and they had a guy there, old revolutionary man by the name of Colonel Michel, and they said he could speak English better than we could, but he always spoke Spanish. It gave him some advantage, I think. But we got along very well with them, and he had younger men working for him that we became good friends with, really. And then, you know, we had the Labor Department man there, too, and we, by and large, got along well with them, too. We all wanted to see, the program work, and so it worked.
Can you tell me on average how many bracetos you think you processed on a daily basis?
Oh, we tried to keep it down. And sometimes, though, farmers, when the cotton's ready to pick, they want it yesterday. They want the workers yesterday. And so we would sometimes run 500 a day or 600 a day. But we tried the 200 to 300 in there. And I'll tell you another story that's kind of interesting. We had a bunkhouse because sometimes we had leftovers. You get it about 11 o'clock at night, and you don't want to work all night, so we had a fellow that would bring them sandwiches on request, so we'd call this guy and he'd bring him some sandwiches for supper, and then we put them in the bunkhouse. And one night as I recall, we had seven beds. And one night we had seven braceros. And I told them, I says, well, we're all done for today. You guys go to the bunkhouse and just find your beds and go to bed, and we'll get farmers for you tomorrow. Well, I was doing some paperwork, and it's about 11:30, and I was closing up, and I thought, well, maybe I'll just go out and see if the braceros got accommodated all right. Well, went out there and turned on the light, and it's cold, it was getting along in the fall, and it's frost every night. And we didn't have any heat in that room, but we had GI comforters for everybody. And that, that's pretty good cover. And so, much to my surprise, I found some of the more aggressive men had two GI comforters, and some of the less, the old peasant types were sleeping under newspapers in cardboard boxes. So I got them all sorted out again, but I thought it was interesting that those people, of course, they were unknown to each other, and when they are a community, they will. But they were all, nobody came from the same village, and so there was just didn't seem to be any thought given to, we got seven comforters, and each one of us ought to get one. And they just, as I say, the big husky ones had two comforters, and the others didn't have any.
Can you describe the process of how the farmer would call you, and can you just describe that and how that would happen, how you would transport them up to the areas? And
well, they would come in and get them. See, we transported them from Rio Vista to our to our center there at Farm Bureau, and the farmers would come in and get them. And one of the things that was, you know, you had the bracero and he had a card, and he wanted to go work with his old patron. And you would call, and the old patron would say, well, I've already got my man. He's a good man, but I can't take him. And the bracero would be very crestfallen, you know. And we'd tell him, well, we got another job, but he still was, you know, the Mexican worker, I think then and now, really values a personal relationship. Then at other times we'd call 10 o'clock at night and we'd say, well, we have a man by the name of Juan Gonzalez here, and he's coming from 70 miles away. Oh, he says, Juan's back. Yeah, I'll be there. And he comes with the whole family, wife and kids, and some real reunion. You know, the kids jump on Juan, and that was one of the most gratifying things about the job. You know, there was a close relationship with these people. These were usually small farmers, you know, and they didn't have a foreman or anything. They valued these people. And I always remember, you know, the Mexican farmers, of course, the Hispanic farmers, got along a little better with their workers than the American did. And I've had Americans say, well, I don't know how Joe Apodaca gets along so well with his people. Why can't I do that? I said, well, you don't speak Spanish and you don't understand them like he does. And I've seen Joe Apodaca bring in 30 men to go home. They get on the bus, and Joe Apodaca would embrace each one. And you know, you can't beat that. That's, you know, he was the patron that those men expected. He valued them, and he was the patron, you know, if they had a sickness or they had some kind of problem, he'd do something for them. And the Anglo farmers, some of them were good too, but they didn't have that, you know, they didn't embrace their workers when they left. They said, you know, just kind of see you, Joe. But that was, you know, to me, the Bracero program was a friendship program as well as an economic program. And I didn't ever feel at all guilty about working with the Bracero program.
What cultural reason could you give for the bond for the bracero that would come over and be loyal to the certain patron or vice versa?
Well, just you feel like, and you know, I was a Peace Corps director in El Salvador for 2 years, so I'm not limited to Mexico, but you know, we had maids in El Salvador, and they would talk about, they worked for someone, and they said, you know, that woman wouldn't say good morning to us in the morning. And the woman probably had no bad intention of that. She was a foreign woman, and she just didn't didn't know or didn't worry about it too much. And those people have their, you know, they want to be spoken to and valued as human beings. And you know, you say a lot of things about Mexico, but Mexico is a humane society in a way that, you know, we think dollars are the way to get people like us. But Mexicans are humane in that, you know, that you don't ever lose your humanity. You may be a prisoner in the jail, but the Mexicans still treat you as a human being. And, you know, I've never quite understood why. I took, you know, University of Oklahoma, we had a center down in Colima, Mexico. And they had a prison there, of course. And we took people down there, and we had in the summer students studying Spanish. And we used to play basketball against the prison team in the prison. And of course they usually beat us because they had nothing else to do but practice. But I took one time a major of the Oklahoma Highway Patrol, and he was helping them with police work, and they'd asked for it. And we visited the prison. And there was a young social worker about your age, and she accompanied us. And we walked right out in the yard with all the prisoners and didn't feel any insecurity. And this man commented, he said, you know, you wouldn't dare take a young woman into the McAllister prison in Oklahoma. He says, hello. He says they would just hoot and holler and insult her and make sexual remarks. He says, you couldn't do that. And I said, well, why do you think that is? Angel, our boss down there at the Hacienda, he says, prisoners don't get sore like they do in the United States. And they treat them humanely. I mean, they don't, it's not in matter of having good plumbing and all that. It's treating them like they were people. And they have a thing that we wouldn't ever do. But they allow wives and girlfriends in to spend the night with prisoners. And they have a special section there that they set aside for that. In their prison, you know, the average American would say, oh, this is horrible. This, you know, it's very primitive. But they just do things. And we were walking in there with the warden. And he was not, you know, no guards with him, just walked in there. And we were going to walk somewhere. And prisoners were constantly talking to him. He was a kind of a young man. And they were just, you know, he'd walk a few steps and another prisoner would grab him and say, you know, I've got this and that. And the Oklahoma State Highway Patrol major said, one thing, this man has good communication with his prisoners. But it's interesting, they people that are trustees in the jail, you know, people that they know won't escape, they'll let them out and sit in the park, you know. And so they're just it's interesting. Now that's a very small prison that I was in. The highway patrolman said, that's another thing. Stateside prisoners are very big, you know, they have 2,000-3,000 inmates. He says that's a tough deal.
When the Bracero completed his contract with the farmer, you said that they were contracted towards to the Farm Bureau, not the individual farmer.
That's right.
Tell me the return process, or did they have to go through your center?
Return process? Well, no, we just take them when the farmer was done. He would bring his people in, and we would make sure that everything was settled out according to the contract. And then we would take them back to the Rio Vista. And I think they took them back to Chihuahua. I think that was their... You know, they had three centers in the States most of the time. One of them is in Monterey, one of them in Chihuahua, and one of them in Hermosillo, Sonora. And they had one in Irapuato. And we took a bunch of old men down there to get them renewed, and that was quite an experience.
Tell me about it.
Well, the Texas people, Oklahoma, you know, Texans are always they're always ahead of the rest of us, you know. But they had made a deal, and I don't know whether they paid. I suspect they had. They paid to get some of their old men renewed. And this was always a, you know, these people 18 months, and they called them key men, and they said we need to have a way where we can keep these men. And so this guy from Texas, the Texas cotton growers, El Paso cotton growers, I believe it was, said, well, we made a deal to renew our men in Irapuato, and will you, do you want to go in with us on it? And I said, well, yeah, we got about 200, and we'd like to do that. And so we went down there to Irapuato, and in the first place, all of our workers were, you know, that's much lower standard of living than northern Mexico. And all of our workers were well-dressed, you know, had good Stetson cowboy boots. And so we were kind of not appreciated there in the first place because we were, you know, they looked on us, we're stealing places that ought to be given to them. And they were in the papers of, they were talking about how tough the managers of the center were, and it was not a real good environment, you know. And so we got down there to get our old men renewed, and in order to become a bracero, you had to have a military card. In other words, you had to have a draft card. And so we got down there with our 200 men, I suppose 20 of them didn't have draft cards. And so I was talking with a lieutenant there in the Army. They were the ones that oversaw that. And I says, you know, what's to be done here? He says, I have to send these men. They say they've served their military service, which may or may not be true. And he said they had to go back to their respective municipios and get a draft card. And so I told these men, and I even telegraphed the different presidencias around, that they were from everywhere, and asked them to please expedite these people getting their draft cards. And so then we got what we could. We left those that didn't have the draft cards, and we had two young guys from Jalisco, and a lot of blonde people in Jalisco, and they were, you know, they were readily recognizable. And we went back by bus. We got to Juarez, and there we were crossing the border, getting through the immigration, and here these two young guys showed up. Well, I went to see the general about getting those cartillas militares, and the general made him quite a speech. He said, you know, you have to be responsible. And he said to me, I bet you've got your draft card in your pocket. Is that correct? And I said, yeah, that's correct. He says, all we're asking is these men be responsible. And then he said to the two of our braceros, they were all gathered there, and he said, you men, remember, what you've got in your pocket in money is what you're worth. So he says, take advantage of your stay in the United States. He made quite an eloquent speech, you know. And I thought, well, you know, can't fight that. He's got the right idea. And these two guys came up, and they had their military. I mean, they were all fixed up with the army. And I said, well, how'd you get to Jalisco so quick and get back? And they said, you know that lieutenant you were talking to? I said, yeah. We said, I had a blank, one of those Micas that a card fits in. And he says, I put 100 pesos in it. And he says, I went to him and says, mi teniente, tenemos nuestra carta militar. And hand it to him. He looked at it and said, oh, muy bien. So that was kind of funny.
That's how I got it. Did you have any problems with braceros disappearing from the farms or leaving?
Yeah, they were, they call them abscondees, you know. Yeah, we had some, but, you know, it wasn't a huge problem because, we usually just as an accommodation to our membership, when that happened, we'd replace them. You know, we'd mark them. They're paid for, let's say, 3 months of insurance, and we just mark that off, and we'd apply it to another man, and we wouldn't charge him a fee on it. So it wasn't a huge problem. Now, to the immigration, I'm sure it was probably something that and the Labor Department worried about it a little, but we didn't worry about it too much.
We're just doing some final reflections now. What is your personal opinion of the Bracero program?
Well, as I say, I thought it was a program in human relations. I thought, by and large, at least in New Mexico, there was gratification on both sides, and it was also a successful economic program. And certainly a lot better than wetback program. I can tell you a story about wetbacks in Norman, Oklahoma, if you...
Sure.
Well, this has been 15 years ago. A reporter, they'd been having a problem. For some reason, the Norman police had gotten into capturing wetbacks, and I never did understand why they did that, because most police didn't want to get involved in that. But we had some wealthy people that raised that played polo, and one of the things that Mexico has a great number of people that know how to work with horses, and so they had. This one fellow had four or five workers on his polo, and he played polo. And he's a wealthy man. He had the Cadillac agency in Norman. And so a farmer or a reporter came to me and says, I want to talk to these wetbacks. I'd like you to interpret. Well, we got down there and we were talking, asked them how they did and everything. And they were... you know, didn't have any complaints except they didn't want to go home. And the reporter said, well, do you have any complaints? And they said, no. The only thing that's worrying us now is that they owe us $700, and we calling the foreman, and the foreman was a Mexican, and he says he won't answer our call. And so we're worried we're going to lose our money. We get sent home. So I asked the jailer, I said, well, immigration, they'll collect his money, their money, won't they? I think there were three of them. And he said, oh, no. He said, they just send a man, a driver with a van. He says, they pick these guys up, take them home. They're not going to do anything. And so we walked out of the jail, and there was the sheriff was there, and he had nothing to do with the Norman police. He's the sheriff of the county. And I knew the sheriff, and I said, "Sheriff, we need to collect the money of these boys." And, you know, here he was. Is he going to go up against a powerful, rich man and collect money? Well, he just reared back in his chair. He's talked like a real redneck. And he says to one of his deputies, "JT, you doing anything?" And the deputy says, "No, sheriff." And he says, "Take Hancock out there and collect these boys' money." And so I went out with a big deputy. I wouldn't go out to a farmer on my own initiative and tell them they had to pay their people. Went out there with the deputy, and we came to the farm, and the man's wife was there, and she says, brought the Bracero with us, one of them, and she says, "Oh, hello, Shorty." And she says to me, "Why are they taking these men? We need these men. There ought to be a way we keep them." And I said, "Well," he says, "you all owe them some money." "Well," she says, "I don't know anything about that, but," she says, "I'll call my husband." And she called him. He's up there at the Cadillac agency. And she says, "They say that we owe Shorty and whoever $700. And the guy says, "Well, pay them $700 and add 50 to it." And so, but that Mexican foreman would have kept their money if the sheriff hadn't. And I always esteemed that sheriff.
Getting the money. I'm sure the people were. What do you think ended the program in your view?
Well, I think you look at this, if you get this program and the Harvest of Shame, if it's on video somewhere, you know, ABC or CBS, it was called Harvest of Shame, and you know, there were people that were opposed to it, and I can never figure out why the Catholic Church was opposed to it, but the Archbishop of San Antonio was one of the big guys that talked against it. And you know, I figured those Braceros were Catholics too, and why he should be opposed to it, I can't understand. And my wife has a brother who's been a career ranch administrator in southern Arizona. They have a ranch 25 miles from the Mexican border. And he says that they're just inundated with wetbacks. That used to be one or two of them would come through, and they knew where they were going, and their patron was expecting them and all of this. And he says, "Now you get 60. And he says, "All those people are carrying pistols down there. They're all have the sidearms. They won't leave the house without them." And because they have, you know, it's one thing to talk to one or two guys, but it's another thing to talk to 50, you know. And so they're all kind of in a state of war down there. And, you know, if the immigration controlled wetbacks, and I forget when it was, it may have been late 1950s or early 1960s, they totally controlled the wetbacks because they had a legal alternative. Now, I realize it's more complicated now. It's a bigger body of people. I think with the maximum wetback program was like close to 500,000. And now, what do they say, about 8 million. But in that year, when the Bracero program was working well, they controlled the wetbacks. And they did this by telling, and then it was primarily farmers that were using wetbacks. Now they're everybody's using them, and they told the farmer, you know, you can get legal workers at your local farm association, and if you don't do that, we'll put you out of business. And they meant it, and they controlled them. You know, there was a year or two right towards the end of that Bracero program where they didn't have very many wetbacks. Certainly farmers didn't use them, because if you said, well, heck, I'm not going to go along with that, they'd station an immigration officer on your farm, and you couldn't get anybody to work. And so they controlled it, and they didn't, you know, in fact, they caught you with wetbacks then. They didn't blacklist you. They just said, you got to go to the Farm Bureau and get workers. And so they controlled it. And I still say, even today, if you have a legal program, the workers would rather have it, and the employers would rather have it. And so why we've gone on with this wetback program for all these years is more than I can fathom. I can't understand it. And I thought Bush was going to do something about it, but then 9/11 came along, and it's been, but they were just telling us, a guy drove us to this hotel, and we asked him, how is it to go to Juarez now? Is it tough? And he said, oh, during this Iraq thing, so it'd take you 2-3 hours to get down there.
True.
If I were king of the world, I would get the immigration to advertise throughout the land, come to immigration office on such and such a street, register your workers, and there will be a legal contract, wages be specified, and in other words, just start a hiring hall for legal workers, and these state departments of labor could run it, federal department of labor, it'd be a pretty big job. But people say, we don't want to give those people green cards, we don't want to give them citizenship, but you don't have to give them a contract and make it tough on the employers that don't go along with it, you see. I think could still be done, but I'm not sure that it will be done. You know, Fox is working towards that. He's given the guys credentials. But if I were U.S. government, I'd say, let's give them credentials and contracts, you know. And if they're supposed to get a certain wage and they're to be insured and there'd be a labor guarantee, to reinstate the old Bracero program. And for everybody, not just for farmers. You know, restaurants could get them too. You know, Oklahoma City, they told me if we were to pick up all the wetbacks, we'd close all the restaurants in Oklahoma City. You know, I'm sure that's true everywhere.
Very true. Thank you, Dr. Hancock, very much.
You bet.